If we took a poll among professional teachers of philosophy on the question, who is the most important living philosopher, it's not very obvious to teachers who would get the most. But we could be fairly sure about some of the names that would be in the top half dozen. Quine, Popper, Jean-Paul Sartre, Chomsky probably, though strictly speaking he's not exactly a philosopher. Well, the first of those names, and one on which I'd lay pretty short odds, is that of Willard Van Orman Quine, one of the professors of philosophy at Harvard. Quine was born in 1908 and is still highly productive, so he's had a long career, and it's by no means over yet. He's published innumerable articles and over a dozen books, the best known of which are From a Logical Point of View, published in 1953, and Word and Object, published in 1960. First and foremost, he's a logician, and the original contributions to the subject which made him famous are for the most part highly technical and not really accessible to the layman, though they always had their ultimate roots in problems fundamental to philosophy. However, in the latter part of his career, he's become more overtly interested in philosophy in a more general sense. And I thought it would be uniquely valuable in this programme to have a philosopher at the very summit of world reputation talking about the basics of philosophy and of his own activity. Professor Quine, what do you regard as the central task or tasks of philosophy?
I think of philosophy as concerned with our knowledge of the world and the nature of the world. I think of philosophy as attempting to round out the system of the world, as Newton put it. There have been philosophers who have thought of philosophy as somehow separate from science and as providing a firm basis on which to build science. But this I consider an empty dream. Science, much of science, is firmer than philosophy is or can even perhaps aspire to be. I think of philosophy as continuous with science, even as a part of science.
Well, if it's continuous with science and even part of science, how does it differ from the rest of science?
It differs in generality and in abstractness. Science is a continuum extending from history and engineering and at one end, if we think of science broadly, to such abstract pursuits as philosophy and mathematics at the other. Philosophy considers the question of the nature of cause, for instance, where physics contents itself with finding causal relations between specific sorts of events, biology between other sorts of events. Again, whereas the zoologist will tell us that there are wombats, and the physicist will tell us that there are electrons, the mathematician will tell us there are no other prime numbers, the philosopher is interested rather in what sorts of things there are altogether. It's in these ways that philosophy is more abstract in general.
In other words, the philosopher is investigating what constitutes the connective tissue of everyone's thoughts, including other people's thoughts. So that the physicist is trying to find out whether or not A causes B, but the philosopher is saying, but what does it mean to say that anything causes anything? The physicist is trying to find out, say, what particular subatomic particles there are. And the philosopher says, but what does it mean to say of anything that it exists?
Yes.
It's at this level of complete generality that the philosopher's investigations occur. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, do you include in this, or do you exclude from it, the age-old questions of how the world got here in the first place, or how life began?
I exclude these from philosophy. How the world began is a problem for the physicist and astronomer, and of course there have been conjectures from that quarter. How life began is a problem for the biologist, on which he's made notable progress in recent years. Why the world began, why life began, on the other hand, I think are pseudo-questions, because I can't I can't imagine what an answer would look like.
And you think that because there's no conceivable answer to these questions, they are, so to speak, meaningless questions?
Yes.
So in other words, you regard the central tasks of philosophy as the analysis and elucidation of concepts that are central to various fields of human activity, and also, in particular, notions like core, what it is for something to be a cause of something else, what it is for something to exist, what it is for something to be, shall we say, a scientific law, the most general notions that are, as it were, the connecting tissue of thought, and that we have to use and have to employ in the specific activities that people like scientists, or it could even be politicians, lawyers, and so on, are engaged in. Is that a correct way of putting your view?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Do you think that the main or the most important questions that philosophers have to deal with can be grouped under any particular headings?
There are two headings, which I think provide an important classification to begin with. They're the ontological questions, as they might be called.
Well, I think you need to explain that term.
These would be questions as to what there is, the general questions as to what sorts of things there are, as well as the question of what it means to exist, what it means to exist, for there to be something. And the other classification, the other class, would be might be called the predicative questions, questions as to what sorts of things can meaningfully be asked about what there is.
In other words, you've got two enormous spheres of questioning here, one about what there is, and the other about what we can know about what there is, or what we can say about what there
is. Yes, and epistemology would be included in the latter.
Yes. Now, I think since you've made this distinction, for clarity's sake in our discussion, we ought to cling to it a little, and I think we'll take these two areas one at a time, and we'll take your first one first, the whole group of questions about what there is, what exists, or as you say, what is called ontology by philosophers. Although there are innumerable theories about this, I think it's fair to say that throughout the history of the subject, there have been two broad opposing views of the matter of ontology between what you might very roughly call materialists and what you might call idealists. And although there are innumerable different versions of both doctrines, you do have on the one hand a view that reality consists of matter, material objects in space and time, which exist independently of anyone's or anything's experience of them. And on the other hand, you have a view of reality as consisting ultimately in spirits or minds, or as existing in the mind of God, or as being put together in our minds. Now, can I put very crudely the $64 question to you and ask you which side you're on?
I'm a materialist.
The materialist,
yes. Yes, I hold that physical objects are real and exist externally and independently of us. I don't hold that there are only these physical objects. There are also abstract objects, objects of mathematics that seem to be needed to fill out the system of the world. I don't recognize the existence of minds, of mental entities, in any sense other than as attributes or activities on the part of physical objects, mainly persons.
Now, that must mean then that you not only reject idealism, it must also mean that you reject dualism. I mean, I might describe dualism as almost a common sense view. I think throughout human history, most human beings have taken the view that reality consists ultimately of entities of two categorically different kinds, minds and bodies. And as far as we know, in all civilizations, past and present, most people seem to have thought this, that there were bodies and that there were minds, and that these were two fundamentally different kinds of thing. And that's what is meant by the term dualism. Now, you must reject this view if you don't believe in the existence of minds.
It's true, I do reject the view. The dualistic view presents problems, creates problems which are neither soluble nor, it seems to me, necessary. It's clear that an individual's decisions will affect his movements, will determine his movements in many cases, and his movements in turn will have consequences in the movements of other physical objects. At the same time, the natural scientist, the physicist, insist on a closed system, there being physical causes, physical explanations in principle for the physical events. They allow no place for the incursion of influences from outside the physical environment. Given all this, it would seem then that a person's decisions must themselves be activity on the part of a physical object. The alternative rejecting this basic principle of physical science to the effect that every change is, that there's no change without a change in the distribution of microphysical properties over space-time, over space. That alternative I find uncongenial because the successes in natural science have been such that we must take their presuppositions very seriously.
In other words, what you are saying is that the wishes, emotions, feelings, decisions, thoughts are all things which take place in physical objects, namely people. And of course, in a sense, that's an obvious fact. And what you're saying is that not only are these always accompanied by microphysical changes, changes in our brains and our central nervous systems and so on, but they indeed are those microphysical changes. Now, before I go on to raise with you some of the apparent difficulties in that view, I wonder if you can explain how it is that almost all of mankind, as I said only a few minutes ago, has disagreed with you about this, and why people in general take a dualist view of reality. Now, I mean, let me add this point. I mean, if I put that question to almost anyone else, he could say, well, it's obvious why people think like that. They think like that because dualism corresponds to directly experienced reality. That is how we experience things. But you can't say that because you don't think it is how we experience things. So what would your answer be?
I recognize certainly a profound difference between so-called mental events externally observable physical ones, in spite of construing these mental events as themselves event states activity on the part of the physical object. The reason, as for the traditional dualistic attitude, certainly this goes back to primitive times. I think one cause of it, partial explanation may be the experience of dreams and the seeming separation of the mind from the body. In that state, certainly animism antedated science. Thales, the first of the Greek philosophers, is said to have said that all things are full of gods. Primitive peoples today are said to be animists very largely, and to believe that what we call inanimate objects are animated by spirits. The one can even imagine traces of animism in the basic concepts of our science itself. The notion of cause, I suspect, that began with the feeling of effort, of pushing on the part of the individual, the subject of feeling, as a mental entity. And force surely had that sort of origin. But as time has gone on and as science has progressed in recent centuries, the dissociation of these concepts from their original mental context seems to have been conducive to great scientific progress, and I think of physicalism as a departure, a product of latter-day science, which of course is a phenomenon that's very uncharacteristic of the history of mankind.
But I don't think that the chief reason why most people take a dualist view of reality is to do with dreams or the other things that you mentioned. I think it's chiefly because we all do have, it seems to me, direct experience of an internal flow of thought, thoughts and emotions and responses and desires and fantasies and memories and so on, which is going on all the time that we're awake, and which is extremely complex, not only in the sense that it may be about complicated things, but also in the sense that there may be several different things going on at once. And I think we're all directly aware of something like this going on inside ourselves. And this doesn't manifest itself in any way in observable external behaviour.
We are aware of these things, and I'm not denying their existence, but I'm construing them or reconstruing them as activities on the part of physical objects, namely our part. The fact that these are not observable on the whole from the outside doesn't distinguish them from much that the physicist assumes in the way of internal microscopic or submicroscopic structure of inanimate objects. A great deal goes on that we don't observe from the outside and that we have to account for conjecturally. The important reason for construing all this activity as activity in part of bodies is to preserve the character of the system of the physical world.
Does this mean that you deny the real existence of the age-old problem about whether or not we have free will?
It doesn't mean that, but the will would retain its status, even though becoming a ultimately a neural phenomenon an aspect of the activity of a physical object. However, I think the problem of the freedom of the will is an outcome of a confusion. There's no question in my mind about the freedom of the will. The will is free in the sense that people very often do what they will to do. They are free to within limits of constraint and within limits of their strength or talent to do things that they will to do. Freedom of the will does not mean that the will is free to will as it will. That would be nonsense. And it doesn't mean that the will is uncaused. The will is caused. And we all are prepared to recognize that the will is caused when we try to train children in such a way as to influence their behavior or enact laws to discourage criminals. Or we try to get votes. People try to sell things. All these are cases of causing people to will. But the freedom of their will remains insofar as their activity is the result of a causal chain, one link of which is the willing. And that willing can be itself caused. It is.
Given that you hold these views, how do you see the traditional body-mind problem? I mean, let me just remind our viewers of what that is. I mean, I've said earlier that most people seem to take a dualist view of reality, the view that everything in the universe consists ultimately of either minds or bodies, that there are both kinds of entity. And that has given rise to a traditional problem, which no one has ever come up with a thoroughly satisfactory solution to, and that is the question, how are these incorporeal, abstract, non-material minds able to actually move and push about the material bodies? Now, it's clear that you, since you don't believe in the existence of minds as independently of bodies, the problem does not present itself to you in that form. Do you, given your views, do you simply bypass the mind-body problem totally?
No. As you say, the body-mind problem doesn't exist in that form for me. There's no longer that problem of interaction, and in fact, it's in order to eliminate the problem in that form that I opt for physicalism. However, the problem then arises, how are we to talk about all these ordinarily so-called mental events and mental activity, this flux of experience, if we're not recognizing minds, not recognizing mental entities. It's no good trying to paraphrase all this into neurological terms, because it would take too much in the way of detailed understanding of the mechanism of the nervous system. Now as a first step, a quick, easy solution to that. One may simply keep the mentalistic terminology, but regard all these terms as terms applicable to bodies and to the activity of bodies. This is easy, this is too easy in a way, because there's another point about the in favor of the physicalistic attitude, which I haven't touched on it now, namely the advantage of intersubjectivity, objectivity. The data are not introspective data, the data are shared, or can be shared, by other observers. It's because of this, in large part at least, that the natural sciences have been so successful. Now, and introspective psychology has not been comparably successful. Well, now, if we simply take over all the conceptual apparatus of introspective psychology and mentalism, and simply try to excuse it by saying all these attributes or activities of bodies, we're no longer getting the benefit of the intersubjectivity of natural science. However, there's a way of coping with this difficulty, and it is behaviorism, in the sense of which I think behaviorism is important and valuable. I think the role of behaviorism is the legitimation of mentalistic terms without having to go through the indirect and, in fact, impracticable channel of neurology. Criteria, observable, intersubjectively observable criteria for mental states are found in behavior, in observable behavior.
Including
verbal behavior, yes. And insofar as such criteria are available, we do have the benefits of natural science after all, and this is without full neurological explanation. So the extent to which I'm a behaviorist is in seeing behaviorism as a way of making objective sense of mentalistic concepts. I don't identify the mental states with the behavior. I identify the mental states rather with neural states. Nor do I regard behavioral accounts as in the last analysis, explanatory of the mental states, mental phenomena. I think the full explanation of these is to be found, rather, at the neurological level.
In other words, you're saying that behaviorism is not an explanation of the kind of problems with which the philosopher deals, but a way of formulating them. I mean, it's a kind of language in which the problem should be couched or formulated before we then go on to try and provide solutions.
Exactly.
I think it would be helpful if we paused a moment at this point, Professor Quine, and if I try to recapitulate the ground that we've covered before we attempt any forward moves. I started this discussion by asking you what you regarded as the central tasks of philosophy, and you not only said what you thought philosophers ought to be doing, you also said what you thought they ought not to be doing, and you ruled out a number of questions, but you grouped the questions that you thought philosophers ought to concern themselves with under two main heads. The first head being questions about what exists, what does reality consist of, and the second group being what can we know about this and how can we know and what can we say about it and so on. Now, from that point onwards, we've been pursuing the first of those two groups of questions. And you said that in your view of reality is physicalist. You think all reality consists in physical entities, that there are not minds separate from physical entities, and that the notion that there are leads us into all sorts of conceptual confusions which you think a behaviorist analysis liberates us from, I'd like us now to start going over to questions of the second kind, because we were beginning to get into them already, and that's why I thought it time to stop and reassess where we were. Can we now move into the second area of how we acquire knowledge of this physical world in which we find ourselves?
Good. Correction I would make, though, my position is not that there are only physical objects, there are also abstract objects.
But these abstract objects are not mental, right? It's important to make that distinction, isn't it?
That's
you it. Don't believe in the existence of minds as separate from physical things, yes. But you do believe in the existence of certain abstract entities.
Yes, right? Numbers notably.
But I think you need to explain that a bit. If you are a physicalist, how can you justify your belief in the existence of abstract entities at all?
The status of sets or classes and numbers and functions, I think, from the point of view of the predicated side of philosophy, is not basically different from the status of hypothetical entities such as elementary particles in physics. In both cases, it's a matter of framing hypotheses which imply our past observations, which imply future observations under specifiable conditions, which would then serve to corroborate or refute these hypotheses. And these general hypotheses contain reference not only to the ordinary observable objects, but also to many auxiliary objects, we might say, in the way of unobservable physical particles, and also in the way of numbers and functions, because these come into the formulations, into the hypotheses of a quantitative kind, and even classes or sets. The biologist speaks of genera and species of organisms, and all these entities are furniture of the world, posited on an equal footing in our system of the world.
Well, you say on an equal footing, but it does seem to me that there is a very important difference between the sense in which subatomic particles are unobservable and the sense in which, say, numbers are unobservable. And subatomic particles are bits of stuff, but it just so happens, perhaps because of the accident of our optical apparatus, that they're bits of stuff which are too small for us to see. But if we had microscopic eyes, or super microscopic eyes, perhaps we could see them, and if we had different kinds of fingers, we could pick them up. I mean, they are bits of material. But numbers aren't bits of material, however small, are they? I mean, they are, as it were, abstract through and through. There is nothing but abstraction to them.
It's true that there's this discontinuity, but the continuity of ordinary observable objects with the elementary particles is rather more tenuous than had once been supposed, because an elementary particle is too small, for instance, even in principle, to be detected by light, because it's smaller than any wavelength. Furthermore, the behavior of the elementary particles is basically unlike that of larger bodies, so much so that it's, I think, only by courtesy that they're called material. The indeterminacy with respect to whether two segments of paths of an electron are segments of paths of the same electron or two different ones. Indeterminacies of position, the antithesis between wave and corpuscle as in the interpretation of light, and other anomalies, something called the Bose-Einstein statistic, all suggest that the analogy of body is an analogy that was useful for extrapolation up to a point, but then the reshuffling, the evolution of hypotheses in the light of further experimentation and further refutations have finally carried us to the point where the continuity is no longer so evident.
I would like to leave that particular point there, Professor Quine, because I want to step back three paces in our discussion and take up something which strikes me as being of very much more general interest, that we were talking about a moment ago, and then we got slightly sidetracked, and I think it was partly my fault that we did. I want to go back to the point where you were saying, or suggesting anyway, that the adoption of a physicalist approach to reality, or a behaviorist analysis, a behaviorist way of formulating problems, has the effect of liberating you from the spell of certain entrenched ways of looking at things, which, though they may be part of common sense, are nevertheless mistaken. Now, that's the point I want to take you up at. Can you say what some of the entrenched ideas are from which you believe your approach would liberate us?
Good. Liberation is one way of looking at it. A sterner discipline is another way of looking at behaviorism. But at any rate, a major example is the notion of meaning. There's the common sense notion that words somehow convey meanings. How do we know that the same words convey the same meaning to two speakers? We can see that the speakers react in the same way. All this is describable in behavioral terms, but might the meanings themselves be different? What behavioral sense could be made of the question? No behavioral sense, no adequate behavioral sense has been made of it. There are other notions that come similarly into question. Translation, once the notion of meaning is questioned, the notion of translation becomes more complex. We can no longer say it's simply a matter of producing another sentence that has the same meaning as the sentence that's being translated. The notion of necessity, again, comes into question.
Well, there are two kinds of necessity.
There are two kinds, yes.
Logical and causal.
Yes. The one commonly is understood as necessity by virtue of the meanings of the words. The sentence is true by virtue of the meanings of the words that it contains. This characterization goes by the board if the notion of meaning does. Then there's the notion of physical necessity, necessity by virtue of physical law. This doesn't depend in the same way on meaning, but by somewhat the same sort of scruples, it also becomes questionable. It's not clear that there's not clear to me that there's a difference between a general truth, a truth in the form of a general proposition, general statement, which just happens to be true, and one that is a law. The term necessary, the adverb necessarily, is in very common use and suggests that perhaps people have a distinction in mind between two sorts of truth, the necessary and the accidental or contingent. But I think the use of the ordinary use of that word can be explained otherwise. I think it's dependent on situation and context. One says necessarily and follows it with a sentence, but when he thinks that the other person is bound to admit it because of what he already has committed himself to, or because he may be presumed to believe, and that this will vary with the context.
So you're calling into question such very fundamental notions of our thinking as causal necessity, logical necessity, the idea of a law, the notion of...
And this, of course...
Yes,
as well, the beginning to disappear from under our feet, and I think one of
about
the
significance of the idea of physics as legislated by cosmogony is significant.
Characterize for us as a whole the kind of view of the world that we're coming out with? Can you...
Well, physics let's proceed again by the interpretive dichotomy between the ontological and the predicational. On the ontological side,
accepting revision of conceptual apparatus discussed by
physical logics.
Simbox earlier on about context. And the context within mathematics is dependent on complete fundamental conceptions of function and classes as equivalent.
Classes of such things, and all classes of such classes, and so on. And mathematicians have known, have discovered over the past century, how all talk of numbers and functions and all other mathematical entities can be paraphrased into talk of the pure set theory of classes. Classes of classes, appropriate ones, can be made to do the work of numbers and of functions and the rest. So we need these. On the other hand, these are abstract objects that I accept. There are others that I would reject. Properties, I would reject, because there's the question of in what circumstances do two descriptions, two characterizations, determine the same property, and in what circumstances do they determine different properties which just happen to be properties of all the same things? The problem in short of individuation, identification of properties. And it's ordinarily said that two clauses, let's say, two phrases, determine the same property if they have the same meaning. But of course, this characterization goes by the board if we don't accept the notion of meaning. In the case of classes, this problem of identification does not arise because classes are identical simply if they have the same members. Properties, I'm persuaded, are dispensable in science. It's not clear how to dispense with the classes. So this would be my tentative ontology, and I would regard it as part of science, so I'm subject to the fallibility of the rest of science. Namely, the individuals and the hierarchy of classes and classes of classes and so on built upon them. The individuals being physical objects. On the on the predicative side, my view is, I think, mainly rather
field
negative. It's one of
The idea of grades as remarks.
Rejecting. Predicates that have too little in the way of behavioral or let's say of observable criteria for their application, or failing that, I think one must also accept theoretical predicates which don't admit of observable of observational criteria, but there one must insist on there being. Pretty firmly related to predicates of the observational kind through laws, hypotheses, better, general physical theory, which makes for a well-knit system of the world which expedites prediction. So that I would insist not that predicates have necessary and sufficient conditions in observation, but that they have a good share in the way of observable criteria, symptoms of application, or that they play quite a promising role in the theoretical hypotheses.
One thing that pleases me very much about the discussion is that none of it so far
physics
has been specifically about language or about words.
Promising role
say
in
that
the
because,
discussion
along
the prospect of explanation involves perspective,
to take
which may involve in
and are sometimes put off by what they take to be the discovery that modern philosophers are doing nothing but talking about words, talking about terms. Analyzing sentences, statements, and so on. And you haven't talked in that way at all. And it's quite clear that the problems with which you are concerned are not problems about language. Nevertheless, someone opening your books, or a student coming to study with you at Harvard for the first time, would find a great deal of your technique of approach to these problems is via the analysis of concepts and therefore careful attention to words, the elucidation of sentences and statements and so on. Why is it that you and other contemporary philosophers adopt this linguistic approach to what are, after all, essentially non-linguistic problems?
One reason is a strategy that I call semantic ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T. Philosophical issues are often concerned with very fundamental traits of one's conceptual scheme. And if two philosophers disagree on such points, it's difficult for them to discuss their disagreement without each of them begging the question, because it's hard to reason and argue without making use of the fundamental principles of one's own conceptual scheme. And a way of avoiding
functional correspondences,
the device of
numbers,
moving up one step semantically and talking about words. And if one makes this move, then one can talk about the rival systems as systems of sentences. One can compare them in point of simplicity and in point of inclusiveness, make a judgment on a shared basis.
Compare Scott's Marx versus
without the
circularity.
The question there.
We're coming to the end of our discussion now, Professor. I would like, just before we do, I'd like to ask you if you can say anything at all, perhaps in the light of the discussion we've had up to this point, about what you are currently working on. I'd have to ask you to be briefer than I would like, because we have so little time left. But I would like you, before we end, to say something about what you're doing original work on now.
Well, at present, I've been writing short things in an effort to elucidate some of the points already in my other writings, or to extend and improve them. There are several problems on which I would like to see someone make breakthroughs. One of them is connected with language, namely the development of some conceptual scheme to take the place of the untenable, old-fashioned theory of meaning. Something more acceptable in the way of theory of what goes into good translation, for instance. This is a job perhaps for linguists, but it's something of philosophical interest, and it's a job also where someone with a philosophical curiosity is apt to be helpful to the linguist. A second one is related rather to psychology. I should like to see a system of concepts developed which would do the work of the old mentalistic idioms of propositional attitude, X believes that P, X regrets that P, X hopes that P, this sort of thing. These idioms are subject to some subtle logical difficulties and complications, and they're very wanting, in large part of their applications, wanting in adequate behavioral criteria. I'd like to see, discourse, but for scientific purposes, some apparatus which would serve the same purposes as these and be free of those faults. The third is related rather to mathematics. Somewhat begrudgingly, I accept the apparatus of abstract objects, sets and the rest, as an auxiliary to science, because it seems to be needed. But I should like to see a minimum basis, an economical basis, and a very clearly intelligible basis for set theory, which was adequate, just barely adequate, to so much mathematics as is needed in natural science. And it might be that if this were developed, it would, among other things, give us a more intuitive understanding of the so-called paradoxes, the antinomies of set theory and their solutions, such things as Russell's paradox, which are familiar to some of our viewers, I'm sure, and not to all, so that might be a good place to start.
Well, we will have to stop. Thank you very much, Professor Quine.
to make a distinction between the context in which Castelnuovo on murky intentionality of attributes and limpid intentionality of classes. The kind of intentionality that is involved in potentially in the perception of the way the so-called extra propositional component in the way that we formulate the theory. Relationship between the way that we formulate the theory as see Penrose on equivalence class formulations.